This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. This is our final Festival Showcase of the season, but we'll be back next summer. Support for our summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. The 69th season of the Aspen Music Festival and School has officially come to a close, but there is still one post-season concert coming up tomorrow featuring Seraphic Fire and a performance featuring the Faré Requiem. We'll also look back on this amazing season with Alan Fletcher and Asador Centurion and look forward to the Aspen Music Festival's 70th season in 2019. First, here's Patrick Dupre Quigley, choral director of Seraphic Fire. First of all, I have to say it's wonderful to have Seraphic Fire here for one last week for all of us music addicts who can't stand the thought that the music festival is over. We can have one or two more little opportunities for denial, so thank you for being here for that. And after your beautiful concert on Monday, I want to be sure people don't miss tomorrow's concert with the Faré Requiem. Can you tell us what's on that program? Was it you that chose the program, or was it you and Asador Centurion here at the festival, or how did that work?
This was a jointly put together between us with Asador and the festival. Mm-hmm. They were very interested in emphasizing the music of France and of Paris. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of at least a choral piece that is more indicative of Parisian fin de siècle life than the Faré Requiem. Mm-hmm. It is a piece that encapsulates all the wonder, the beauty, even the fashion and the je ne sais quoi of Parisian life, particularly at the Madeleine Church where it was composed for, where Faré was the organist. It is a piece that stands in stark contrast to the Mozart Requiem, which we performed last week. Mm-hmm. Unlike the Mozart Requiem, instead of emphasizing pain, struggle, trial, it emphasizes peace, calm, almost a Zen-like nature to the texts that Faré chose to set, mm-hmm. as well as the music that he sets it to. There is very little fast music in the Requiem. It is to French music what I think the Barber Adagio for strings is for American music. Mm. It is a national song of mourning. It is a time and a place. It smells and tastes and feels exactly like the place that it was composed for. And I think that's really the brilliance that Faré brings to the form of the Requiem. We get to perform two Requiems. There's very few times that you could do that in under 7 days. And so those of your listeners who were able to be at the Mozart Requiem, I think they will find this to be a very interesting contrast. On the first half of that program, we're actually performing a number of pieces that are written for very large professional choir. Seraphic Fire, when we are by ourselves, we perform usually with between 10 and 17 people on any given program. There's a great tradition in Europe of these large radio choirs, which will often have somewhere between 24, 36, and larger numbers who will perform music together. We have the luxury this year of having an incredibly talented group of 40 students who we're working with for 10 days. They sing with us for the Mozart Requiem and are singing with us for the Faré Requiem as well. And on the first half, we'll perform these gigantic 16 vocal part pieces, which have a broad range of vocal effects, music that is so not performed because the forces that are required to perform that are so seldom available in the United States. John Taverner passed away recently, has these very large works, very large in terms of the forces, not in terms of length. Both of these these pieces are somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes total. So on the second half, we have one long piece that is a through composed piece by one composer. On the first half, we have these gigantic pieces in terms of musical content, but very small in terms of how long they last. And so the first half is this patchwork of miniatures, sort of postage stamps of the brilliance of the human voice. What 60 people, all of whom have advanced training in music, when you put them together, what can they sing from the music of Gabrielli till music that was written 5 years ago?
And if I may ask, Patrick, listening to you talk about this, there's an additional challenge when putting together a program. It's not just artistic that you're thinking about. You're thinking about how is this going to be a good experience educationally for the students?
Absolutely. And our students who are participating in the Professional Choral Institute here at Aspen have come here not only to experience what it means to be a professional singer on a professional schedule with a substantial amount of music to rehearse and perform in extremely limited amount of time. We have that as an experience, but we can also give them the experience of singing music that they would never be able to sing anywhere else, unless they were singing in a professional choir that had decided to tackle this very style of repertoire. Music for, in the case of the Gabrielli, three choirs, or in the case of the Wagner that's been arranged by Gottwald, for 16 voices. This is not music that's performed at university very often. It's not music that you can go to a workshop and work on. And so part of the educational experience is for people to feel what it means to sing these pieces that we've heard on CD so many times, these wonderful, gigantic pieces of music that are at the pinnacle of choral composition, but require so much from the actual ensemble that often the finances to make it happen are prohibitive. We don't get to sing this music on our normal program, and I would doubt that any of the students who are coming here have sung many of the pieces on that first half of the program for Wednesday. It's an incredible, incredible mixture. If someone was sort of wondering, do I like choral music? Do I like hearing people sing this sort of thing? Our program to close our time here at the Aspen Music Festival is about as good a sampler as you're going to get. It touches literally every base that you could probably touch, from different languages, music in English, in Latin, in German, in Russian, in Church Slavonic. It runs the gamut. And so not only is it an educational experience for our students, but it'd also be a very educational experience for our audience who might be looking to broaden their horizons in terms of other music that they could listen to and a whole different repertoire that they may never have heard before.
Would you care to comment a little bit about what it's like to work here in Aspen?
You know, I think that one of the things that we're really thankful for is our partnership with the Aspen Music Festival. They have made this experience so incredibly welcoming for us and for our students. And this being the first year that the Professional Choral Institute is being based in Aspen, it's been in other places before, I think that we are forever indebted to them to giving not only a great and professional and high quality experience to these students, but also the history that the Aspen Music Festival, as you walk around the campus, you just feel like you're standing in places where people who are much better than you have stood. And so it's sort of a gauntlet thrown down to you just from the moment that you walk onto campus that you don't get to give bad performances here.
I am a former student of the Aspen Music Festival. So when this idea of this partnership came to light, it came knowing my own experience, being able to work alongside professional artists. I was here for 3 summers, 98 through 2000. I grew more as an artist here because I got to not just study with my teachers, but perform next to them. And the experience we're going to give to our students, and we have given to our students, to work with what may be their future colleagues and see what it takes to put on these concerts. And that's what Aspen Music Festival did for me, and that's why I'm excited to be able to do this for new choral artists.
I also think that one of the great things about students who come and work with us and that we found over the years is that what they learn here, they bring back to wherever they go. We've had many students who have gone on to very large careers. Some of them are running university programs now. Some of them are singing all over the country. I think that that's the most important thing that we do here. Professional choral singing is at the same level as orchestral playing is in the United States today.
Mm-hmm.
These musicians who make up professional choirs in the United States, we started 17 years ago. There were very few ensembles that worked with people outside of the locations that they were when we started. There's this robust professional choral community in the United States that has happened in the past decade that people who experience this at the Mass Music Festival often will go back to their own communities and will find that there is a professional choir there who is performing equally interesting work, mm-hmm. equally interesting repertoire that can be a great addition to their musical lives. Certainly at the time of Schumann and Brahms, people went to choral concerts in the same way they went to orchestra concerts. It was mm-hmm. music. You go to a concert for music. We weren't in a commodified system where things were in different boxes. And I think that as professional courses become more prevalent in the United States, I hope that the legacy of the Professional Choral Institute and of the various professional choirs around the country who've been doing this for quite some time now, Conspirare, the Choir of Trinity in New York, the Los Angeles Master Chorale, Chanticleer, Cantus, those ensembles along with Seraphic Fire have made a real case for the professional choral ensemble being an integral part of the musical life of any community, no matter how large or how small.
Mm-hmm. Can one of you tell us a little bit about the origin of that name, Seraphic Fire?
Sure. It's actually a reference to the first piece that we ever performed.
Mm-hmm.
One of our great commitments at Seraphic Fire is to the music of American composers, whether they be alive or dead. And the mm-hmm. first truly American composer is a man called William Billings. And he wrote a piece called Invocation. And the first line was, Majestic God, our muse inspire, and fill us with seraphic fire. It's sort of our fight song these days.
Right.
And when we started...
So you have a bass drum booming as you go along.
Exactly. Trumpets and a marching band. But we often sing it at our anniversaries, and it's sort of part of the gestalt of the organization. But it really sort of speaks to our roots in American music and also in historical music as well.
If you've just joined us, we've been talking with Patrick Dupre-Quigley at Seraphic Fire about tomorrow evening's final post-season concert with the Fare Requiem, as well as music of Taverner, Park, Büchner, and Gabrielli. Finally, our final festival showcase interview, as always, is with Alan Fletcher and Asador Centurion. We compare notes on concerts that really stood out, what we gained from a season heavily tilted towards the theme of Paris, City of Light, and what we can look forward to next year. Well, Alan and Asador, in past years I've often asked you what the biggest challenge has been for the Aspen Festival for the year, but this year the answer I think is pretty obvious, and that's the fires. I think it affected many people personally, and mm-hmm. it affected the festival and perhaps even attendance during that time. Can you say a little bit about what you all had to overcome just in terms of some of the practical problems and challenges that the fire presented for you all?
Sure. Well, number one is the majority of our staff live down in the fire zone, as mm-hmm. I do myself. And so it was hard for them, just coming and going. And emotionally, I would say, it was hard to leave one's house. And then we found that that transferred to attendance, because a great many people who normally come up from Glenwood, Carbondale, Basalt, just didn't, and understandably mm-hmm. so. Our attendance was down about the same percentage that restaurant sales were down in July. Mm-hmm. So we think those did correlate, as well as the difficulty of flying in for quite a period. Asador was organizing driving from Denver Airport for all of the artists who come in every single day.
Yeah, I think that we did, however, see a rebound once stress level. So the upshot is that we did get back on track partway through the summer.
Yeah, the last two weekends were on target.
I have to say, here at Aspen Public Radio, we were the one source of information that would have existed had there been an actual power failure.
Mm-hmm.
Emotionally, from my point of view, I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be up here giving information about the fire. I thought I was the classical music announcer, but it was going to be that. And you were facing the possibility of shutting down the entire festival for
a
while.
Yes, absolutely. It was more than 50-50 mm-hmm. for a while that would happen.
Right.
And of course, we were in touch with the sheriff about possible evacuation of all of our students.
Mm-hmm.
So
You know, there's always this, the show must go on is true in theater, and of course it's obviously true with the festival. Are there any good show must go on type stories that might have arisen from the harrowing month of July?
Well, mostly I just want to say thank you to the firefighters, because mm-hmm. having seen the fire at very close quarters myself, I know how frightening it is, and the idea that they go towards it as opposed to running away from it is most impressive.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the show must go on, one of the great concerts of the summer, of course, was Das Lied von der Erde. Mm. And even though Jamie got sick, you found somebody very, very quickly who is extremely qualified to sing, yes. Michelle DeYoung. Tell us a little bit about that, and then also the same thing with the Sharon Isbin concert the week after with Isabel Leonard.
Yeah. Well, we were so lucky. Michelle lives in Boulder. It happened she was in Boulder for that weekend. And of course, she's one of the great singers of that role in the whole world. So that was just a very fortunate thing for us. And it was a stupendous performance, I thought.
And in the case of Isabel Leonard, she has a little child who passed on his flu to his mom.
Right.
And Sharon contacted me, and we were very quickly, given our brilliant resources here among our faculty, we were able to, between Sharon's solo repertoire and Britton Smith having recently performed the Defia songs in the cello, mm-hmm. transcription, were able to rescue a wonderful program.
It turned out to be a program that the audience was raving about. Sometimes it's very exciting. I mean, I hate to say it, because from your point of view, you're tearing your hair out. From the point of view of an audience, it's just like, oh, okay. And then they have a great show and they go home very happy.
Yep.
So congratulations on doing that.
Thank you.
I also want to ask, this just came up for those of us that were lucky enough to hear the final concert. When I was there for the final rehearsal that morning, I saw and heard the bells and found out that you had imported them from Dallas. And mm-hmm. this seems to be not an uncommon thing for the Aspen Music Festival to do. I mean, most people, when they're playing the Symphonie Fantastique, just hit the chimes. And
yes.
and that's okay, but it doesn't have that sound of doom the way those
right.
bells did.
Right.
Can you give me, well, you can talk about that a little, and maybe are there other examples of things that you did this year that were really above and beyond?
I was sitting on Sunday with some experienced orchestral musicians, and when the bells happened, they said, ooh, those are good.
Yes.
But I'm reminded of the time we ended with Mahler 6, and we had borrowed the box from Chicago, I think, and Garrison Keillor was appearing the next day. So mm-hmm. he happened to be at the concert, and after the concert said, I have to have that box in my show. And I said, it's on a truck on its way back to Chicago. We called the truck and intercepted it in Denver, and it turned around and brought the box back so that he could have it in his show.
Oh, that's wonderful. Every year, there's a pattern, of course, with show after show being very similar in some ways, but then you have special things like nothing you've ever done before. One thing that was a big surprise for me was the Disney. And a lot of people ahead of time were complaining and saying, oh my God, Disney, schlock, you know, all this kind of thing. But then when people got to actually see a live orchestra playing with the animation and all the different technical things that were going on there, it was actually quite an education, I think, yep. just for audience members and for the orchestra to even play yep. something like that.
You know, that is exactly my favorite aspect of the whole Disney project, was the kids who saw how important the orchestra is. And they will have seen those Disney movies a million times mm-hmm. and never thought about that there were musicians contributing in that
right.
way.
If I could say I wished one thing, and if anything like that happens again, I would have to say I wished that that conductor could have been made to do master classes or lectures or things like that, because what I found was that there was a lot of interest among the composers, the conductors, the audience, the orchestra members, like, how do we do this? How do mm-hmm. we, you know, almost, it's almost like, how do we get into this? Because this and video games are the future for some musicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say that Disney's team was very skeptical when we kept using the word students mm-hmm. and what they imagined they were going to encounter.
Yes.
They wanted more than double the amount of rehearsal that we scheduled. And then when the conductor came, having recently conducted Chicago Symphony in a Disney program, not that one, because we were the premiere of it, he actually canceled rehearsals because he said our orchestra was so good.
That's great to know. And another thing that I think was something I'm not familiar with was you have a pianist, Joyce Yang, who's one of the world's greats, and mm-hmm. she's playing with the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very powerful. In fact, I didn't know whether to listen or to watch because mm-hmm. it was almost too much because her playing is so great.
Oh, and Joyce brought that to us. It was her idea that there could be a ballet to Carnival, and she came to us and said, do you think that is feasible? And then we connected her with Aspen Santa Fe Ballet.
There's a really wide range of performers. I think about the very, very seasoned Emerson String Quartet who gave us the late Beethoven quartets, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And then you have people like the Junction Trio, these fierce young musicians who gave me a rendition of the Ravel piano trio like nothing I'd ever, I didn't even know Ravel had it in him to play in such a gutsy way. Can you talk a little bit about the contrast of the performers that you choose? Because obviously there's a really wide range of performance style and technique that you bring to our audiences here.
Well, the Junction Trio, made up of Stefan Jackiev, Conrad Tau, and Jay Campbell, they're all alumni of the festival, but did not study at the same time, although they're contemporaries. They had worked together somewhere else in some festival where they were asked to work together, and they found real chemical harmony there and decided to take some time out of their solo careers to dedicate to this. There were two trios this summer of that same nature, and the other one was the Zen Trio, also three soloists, and we don't get this literature, number one. Number two, prepared and performed at this highest level. Your reaction to the Ravel is absolutely the kind of synergy and electricity that we are looking for when we are inviting artists of different sensibilities to the festival.
An interesting thing too for me as a string quartet lover is the two of your string quartets have had somewhat recent personnel changes, the Emerson Quartet and the Pacifica, and to hear them playing and to see how they're already really playing their hearts out in their own individual and very different ways.
Yeah, I think that is helped along when the people who are the core are very powerful musical personalities. And Takash is the same way. When Jerry Walter came in, a lot of people thought, oh, it'll just never be the same. And yet it was a new, wonderful thing.
Yes. I do have to say as well, when I'm here for the first week and I hear the orchestras the first time, my expectations are not super high. I'm just figuring they're still coalescing as an organization, as an ensemble. This is the year that, for whatever reason, all three of the big orchestras that play on a regular basis sounded very, very strong on their first concert. Did you notice that?
I did feel that way, and I felt as though the Wednesday Orchestra, Aspen Philharmonic, was the best it's ever been all the way through the season. But we do take a lot of care to have great teaching conductors in that first week.
Yes, and I think we experienced a wave of new students, and so I think we would share your apprehension, but they turned out to be terrific, very engaged, very well prepared. Our faculty are involved in preparing them as well. And throughout the summer, we had week after week, brilliant, brilliant, insightful performances.
I want to give a shout out to the whole vocal department, all the singers in the opera. And also, I think Ed managed to pull off something. Frankly, Tales of Hoffman has not been my favorite opera for a long time because I have a real hard time with a guy falling in love with a wind-up doll. But he managed to make it work dramatically for me, so I kind of got over that hump and I could just enjoy the great music and also feel swept along by the story somehow. And it seems to me as though the vocal part of this whole program, I just seemed like I was exposed to more of it, from the Boulez to the, you know, Susanna Phillips recital to a really wide range where they just sort of appear on chamber concerts. Can you say a little bit about how you see the vocal program is coming along this year?
Well, I think we had more intermingling, and partly because of the French theme, because harp song is so important in French music, and thus we had it in the chamber music concerts to a much higher degree than we usually do.
We're going to make a convert out of you, Chris.
No, I've been made a convert as far as the Tales of Hoffman. That won me over.
Terrific. Yes, and as Alan said, the literature lent itself to these opportunities, and we had the voices here. It was great to hear a wide range of repertoire.
And you brought up the whole French theme, and I have to say I thought that worked very, very well this year. For myself, I know French music very, very well. I know all the repertoire pretty well, but being able to focus on it as a radio announcer for a whole season and realizing just, oh my God, how much great, there was never any lack of music for programming. I never had to go down to second tier music just to say, okay, now we're playing French music. Right. It's great music all over the place. I don't know how the audience in general responded, but Karen and I had a blast with it. We really enjoyed it.
Great.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could tell us about next year. I've already heard that it's going to be about American music as a kind of a theme. So maybe if one or both of you can say a little bit about how the theme is going to play out to the extent that you know at this point.
Sure. It is our 70th anniversary season. 1949 was the first Summer of Music. So we thought American is the way to go. Aspen, from its beginning, has been very American-centered in contrast to some other festivals. It also seems like a good time to reflect on the importance of immigrants to American mm-hmm. music culture, because from the beginnings of classical music culture in the U.S. up to the current day, the presence of people from other countries has been a key to success.
The first thing that comes to mind immediately for me is World War II and the people escaping the horrors of Nazism, mm-hmm. of course.
But even the founding of the great orchestras in the 19th century, there was an important presence of musicians from Europe. Mm-hmm. And now it's musicians from Asia.
Do you know either of the operas that are going to be performed next season?
It'll be Mozart's Figaro and A Little Night Music.
This must be near and dear to your heart, Alan, just because you are one of the many American-trained artists, composers, musicians, and maybe a generation or two before you, almost everybody would have to go to France or they'd yes. have to go to Germany or someplace like that. No longer necessary, is it?
No, that's right.
It's optional. I just wonder if maybe we can weave any stories in that just might be interesting or funny or inspiring, things that happened this season that were a little off the beaten track that I don't really know how to ask about because I wasn't there.
Funny. Well, there was that occasion when Augustin Haderlich broke his bow in the middle of Ligeti rehearsal. So I received a phone call from one of my staff members to say that rehearsal came to a stop because Augustin was rehearsing mm-hmm. his recital. And in the middle of the Ligeti concerto, the bow broke, fortunately, from the tip as opposed to the middle. Mm-hmm. And things came to a halt. And quickly he was offered several bows.
Sure.
Rehearsal went on, but he really bemoaned the fact that this is the bow. This is
my bow.
Well, it's also kind of, you know, a way, a lucky charm. And
yes. uh-huh.
So it was quickly shipped off to New York to be repaired and shipped back in oh, time God. For the performance. So that was an Aspen special.
I guess that's lower shipping costs, at least than the church bells. Well, thank you again, both of you, for a great season. Frankly, I don't know how you do it. I'm kind of in awe of there being 300 concerts in just under 8 weeks that somehow, I can't say they go off without a hitch because we know the hitches happen, but then the hitches get repaired so quickly. It's just unbelievable. So congratulations to both of you on a great season.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
We've been talking with Alan Fletcher and Asador Centurion from the Aspen Music Festival and School with a wrap-up discussion of the past concert season at the Aspen Music Festival and School. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. This is our final Festival Showcase of the season. I'm Chris Moore. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. You can listen to previous interviews on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.